For a long time, we thought bigger was better. Church growth and numbers dominated our thoughts and conversations. But now more than ever, people are feeling disconnected. Trust in the church is dwindling. Desizing the Church is a new book by pastor and author Carl Vaders that invites us to consider how removing church size from the equation can be essential in rebuilding trust, restoring relationships, and renewing our spiritual lives. Desizing the Church reframes the way we see fruitfulness and success in ministry. It's time to end the obsession with church growth and focus on what really matters. Pick up your copy of Desizing the Church today at moodypublishers.com.
Hi, my name's Courtney Doctor, and I'm the Director of Women's Initiatives at the Gospel Coalition. My friends and I lovingly refer to the women we see once a year at TGCW as our camp friends, because the time we enjoy together at a conference feels just like a week at camp. And I want to encourage you to invite your camp friends, the people you want to sit beside as you listen to great teaching, worship, stay up late chatting about theology and life, and just have fun. And if you don't have camp friends to bring, come and meet some new ones. The final price increase is on May 8th. This is your last chance to save on your registration. Sign up at tgcw24.org. I really hope to see you there. That's tgcw24.org.
Welcome to Gospel Bound, a podcast from the Gospel Coalition for those searching for resolute hope in an anxious age. I'm your host, Colin Hansen, and each week I'm joined by insightful guests to talk about their written work and how the gospel applies to all of life. Together, we keep looking until we see God working. Wherever you're listening, welcome. I'm glad you're here for today's conversation. When I teach on cultural apologetics, I open each class session with a segment I call Making the Modern Mind. We discuss a technological artifact from throughout history and how it changed culture, including religious life. Artifacts include movable type, the cotton gin, and electricity. One of our most important sessions covers the smartphone. Now, you probably had one if you're listening and watching here for the last 10, maybe even 15 years. You know it's useful in a wide variety of ways, like the Swiss Army knife of the internet age. You're almost certainly listening to me now on a smartphone, and beyond making your life somewhat easier and somewhat more distracted, have you considered, though, the story that your smartphone tells? Has ubiquitous access to the internet brought about by the smartphone made wisdom easier for us to attain, or made wisdom more attractive for us to pursue? Well, Samuel James explores these fascinating and vital questions in his new book, Digital Liturgies, Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in an Online Age, published by Crossway. Samuel is the Associate Acquisitions Editor at Crossway and author of a newsletter of the same name, Digital Liturgies, where he covers Christianity, technology, and culture. In his newsletter, you're going to get his thoughts on everything from Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce to The Crown on Netflix. Some of my interests there as well, Samuel. In this book, he summarizes the story of the internet age. He writes this, quote, "The digital liturgies of the web and social media train us to invest ultimate authority in our own stories and experiences as they separate us from the objective givenness of the embodied world," end quote. To be more specific, we become users, known by words, pictures, and shares, instead of flesh and blood, voices, and facial expressions. Now, Samuel explains that this story is not accidental. It was explicit from the architects of our age. According to Samuel, they told, quote, "a story of humanity wherein salvation consists of overcoming givenness itself, curating a custom existence, and achieving freedom from boredom, limitation, ignorance, and even death," end quote. Well, we need biblical wisdom then to understand and resist these cultural narratives to thrive in our time. We need God's help that we might love him and love our neighbors as ourselves. So Samuel joins me on Gospel Bound to understand more of the digital story and offer advice to parents, pastors, and even the editor-in-chief of the Gospel Coalition. So Samuel, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Colin. It's great to be here.
First question, I have to read this quote and ask if you really mean it. We're going to do a little truth test here. You're right. Quote, every person living in a modern, digitally connected culture is constantly inhabiting a moral and intellectual habitat that distorts the biblical story of reality. End quote. Now, Samuel, you've probably heard, just as I've heard from many different people, technology is supposed to be neutral. So is this really any different from the TV era, radio era, newspaper era? Explain.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think the best answer to the neutrality question, I actually heard from Tony Reinke, and I think he was quoting someone else. And I'm sorry, I can't remember who he was quoting, but he said something to the effect of, technology is neither good nor bad nor neutral. And that's a very provocative idea because it suggests that technology operates on human society at a much deeper level than simply the level of volition, the level of conscious choice. So when we ask, like, what kind of world does technology create? Well, this was the question that really animated Marshall McLuhan back in the early 20th century. And McLuhan's who's famous for the sentence, the medium is the message. McLuhan's entire idea was that regardless of what users of technology intend to do with it, the technology itself has kind of this identity that creates a world in its image. And this is true of all technology. It's not simply digital. It's not simply 21st century technology. If you take the jet airplane, so the jet airplane, which you might use to go on vacation with your family or go share the gospel overseas or any number of virtuous uses, the jet airplane creates a world that now has the plausibility of its own potential written into it. So this is why you get like massive airports, and this is why businesses can hire people to work in one city while they may live in a different one. So it creates this kind of social domino effect where the availability of this technology leads to a world that actually looks like this technology was always here. And I think McLuhan, the example from McLuhan that stayed with me was the example of the railroad. So when the railroad is created, and towns and even states and territories are connected, you have railroad cities that grow up around those the major rail stations. And then you have particular industries that take off in response to rail, so like the steel industry and things like that. And all of this creates a different kind of world than if you never had this technology. So when we apply that kind of thinking to the digital age, to the internet age, what becomes very important is identifying what the digital age is. So it's this very autonomous feeling technology that basically presents to us the power to be, to consume, and to kind of place our attention anywhere we wish, independent of the kind of person that we are, where we're located, where we're situated. So the ability to kind of direct my attention and direct my energy in any direction at all, regardless of where I am, regardless of who I am, has in itself a worldview that is itself a worldview. And that worldview creates different things in response to it. And so we are different kinds of people. We think about our own bodies and our own selves and our own powers differently because we have the ability to look at anything, to consume anything, to purchase anything, to put ourselves in any particular context, regardless of where we were born, of where we live, who our parents are. And so that radical divorce from givenness, from the things that simply are, the identity that we must receive, that radical divorce from givenness makes us certain kinds of people. And what we choose to do with that will not always be bad things. Obviously, we can do great things through these technologies. The question is, does the technology have a mind of its own? And I think the answer is yes.
I think this next question then is probably pretty closely related. Would the transgender revolution we're living through be possible without the internet?
Well, whether it's possible or not, that's a really intriguing question. I don't think we ever want to underestimate the depravity of the human heart. So never tell the human heart what it could not come up with if it didn't have X technology. But I think at one level, the answer could be no. There is no transgender revolution without the internet. And listeners of Gospel Bound, several of them might be also familiar with The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling, which was a long-form podcast by the Free Press. And there's an episode of that podcast, which is not produced by Christians. It's not written by, you know, people who are necessarily thinking about things from a biblical worldview. But there is an episode of that podcast where they come very close to saying that Tumblr was instrumental in the creation of the transgender revolution, because Tumblr had this particular ecosystem that combined kind of erotic fan fiction with this fan culture of people identifying as their favorite characters and kind of almost wanting to do this role play as things that they saw in entertainment. And for a non-believing podcast to actually come as close as they do to saying that the transgender revolution is downstream of the way the internet has kind of just shaped our souls and our minds is remarkable. And I think it absolutely is the case. I think it's one thing to say, and this has been a staple of the sexual revolution forever, it's one thing to say that as long as it doesn't hurt anybody, as long as it's in the privacy of your own bedroom, you can do whatever you want. And so that has been with us for a very long time. What is radically new is the idea that if I say I'm one thing, then you must agree with me. You must agree with whatever I identify as. And I do think that is indicative of a world in which we have become accustomed to inhabiting almost like digital persona. So the digital persona is whatever I create. I don't exist online independent of the content I produce. There is no Samuel James on the internet, independent of the pictures that I upload, the tweets that I send, the things that I write. There is no Samuel James on the internet. Now, in real life, it's different. I inhabit a body. You can come, if you haven't heard from me for a year, you can come see me at my house. I am a person independent of my output. That's not the way it is online. And so the way output gets conflated with identity means that if I choose to produce this kind of content, if I choose to put this out there, then you must accept that as my given identity. And I absolutely think that that is very dependent upon the technological age in which we live.
Let's look at another underlying concept. It's the difference between content and form. Could you explain the difference between content and form, and then also explain why do evangelicals struggle so much to make this, well, really to understand this distinction?
Yeah, absolutely. So content is probably what we're thinking of as evangelicals when we think of purity and the internet. So if you think of being a Christian on the internet, immediately your mind probably goes to avoiding certain sites. So not looking at what you shouldn't be looking at, not saying things you shouldn't be saying. You're thinking in terms of the particular images, the particular media that is presented to you on the internet. So that's content. Form is how those images are brought to you in the first place. So and whether or not it's something that is explicit, that is sinful, or whether it's something that is not necessarily sinful, like a podcast or a TED Talk, the form is the same in both cases. And so the question is there a relationship between content and form? In other words, does form, the technical identity of something independent of what it produces, does that have some influence over the kind of thing it will inevitably produce? And I think it does. And Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman and other technology critics believe that it did, that form dictates content eventually. That eventually what you see out of the machine is what the machine was built to give you. And so I think evangelicals struggle with this, everybody struggles with it. You know, so evangelicals are no different from, you know, most people in that regard. I don't think most Americans are thinking this deeply at a level between form and content. But I think evangelicals have been unable to kind of lead from ahead on this issue, primarily because we don't really have a theology of things. We don't have a theology of material things. We're constantly kind of, this is a bad word, but you know what I mean. We're constantly spiritualizing. we're constantly kind of looking for the immaterial, for the platonic, so to speak. And I think what that has left us with, Colin, and you've written on this, you know, we've kind of lost the theology of the local church as evangelicals over the last few years. I think that's one of the reasons why we've lost the theology of local church is because people are so used to saying, well, the church isn't a building, so I am the church. So wherever I am, I'm having church. And biblically, you can't say that. Like, that's just not the image of the local church. And I think one of the reasons why is because the Bible's theology of the local church is more earthy. It's more physical. It's more tangible. It's people gather together for a particular purpose. And so I think evangelicals have struggled to articulate a theology of ordinary things. And one of the things that I talk about in the book, you know, it's interesting how much of the Old Testament is the Lord giving his people physical objects and physical rituals and physical places that are all part of their worship. It's not as if he simply gives them the Torah and says, okay, now it's your job Monday through Sunday to just remember this and try as best you can. He gives them festivals. He gives them a Sabbath. He gives them clothing. He gives them a temple, right? There is this great attention to the way that physical reality interacts with our souls. And I think evangelicals really need to be recovering that, because in the digital age where we're increasingly abstracted from physical reality, there's just a lot of need to recover a sense of what is real.
Yeah, you've got stirred up a lot of thoughts in that response. One of them is, I was just trying to think of what is it about evangelical spirituality that struggles with the tangible and struggles with the church, struggles with the ecclesial? And I was just thinking about how, especially if you're a North American evangelical, but including some Anglo-Americans, the three formative experiences that have defined our movement were all anti-church. First, the Reformation. That was a recovery of the gospel, but against the hierarchical church in the West. Then again, the evangelical awakening, especially in its English or British manifestations, go to the fields. And there was a strong note on both sides. I mean, Edwards was a church figure, but there was a lot of opposition from churches and a lot of criticism of church leaders. So, you know, Whitfield's locked out of pulpits. He goes to the fields. You know, we can experience God even better, perhaps, in the field. And then, again, the fundamentalist response, which then helps to produce the evangelical awakenings after World War II, it's also because they've lost the churches. They've lost the denomination, especially the Northern Baptists, Presbyterians. That's a response to that. So it occurs to me, I can see then why evangelicals, why we have a hard time, is because our formative stories all have to do with sort of the experience of the spiritual when you are expunged from the tangible and the hierarchical. Hadn't quite thought about it that way. All right, completely pivoting from that. I know this is an impossible question, but I still ask it in my classes, and it's instructive if no other reason than as a thought process. Let's take our kids, our grandkids, our great-grandkids in 100 years. They're going to look back on our era. This is a defining era because of the rise of the internet, also the personal computer, also the smartphone. Now also we're seeing artificial intelligence. Which one of those do you think would be remembered? They might all be remembered in some sense, but which one of those would stand out? And I know you could easily say, probably we don't even know because something else is going to come. Well, I mean, that's possible, but pick one of those and explain why.
Well, Colin, it doesn't matter because this is a simulation, and in 100 years, like the aliens will just pull the plug and start a new save file.
In other words, so, the Matrix is what you're telling me. They're all going to remember, yeah. Neo.
Yeah. So if I had to guess now, I would probably say the smartphone, and here's why. I think the smartphone is at the center of a infrastructure revolution in society that the other things that you mentioned are not quite eliciting. So, and I think COVID perhaps accelerated this, but I know the NFL, to take one somewhat trivial example, but the NFL is trying very hard to phase out physical ticketing. And I think a lot of stadiums already have. So, and you're talking about like in terms of physical event tickets, this is something that literally goes back hundreds of years. Like people have had paper tickets forever. And so, and then you're also thinking in terms of finance and, you know, I don't want to get too speculative because, you know, Bitcoin's rise and fall and then, you know, plateau is an example of how it's a fool's errand to prophesy these things. But I do think like the way that finance is changing in response to people just being on their phones and doing finance from their phones and things like that. I think the smartphone, it represents the hardware revolution. And right now, and I think hardware revolutions tend to be more permanent than software revolutions. Okay. It's one thing to kind of have a different website or a different app or, you know, a different way of doing things. But the, I mean, legally the smartphone, Colin, I know you know this too. The fact that I can do my boarding pass, my ticketing, everything from my smartphone, I don't even have to have a physical boarding pass anymore. And now a lot of airports are getting to the point where you can do facial recognition and, and you know, with in connection with your phone to board a plane. The hardware revolution seems at this point in time to be more likely to be something that we're still kind of we're still living with 100 years from now, even when maybe other technologies have fallen by the wayside or been so retooled that they're not recognizable. But I do think the smartphone revolution is probably here to stay at least for a very long time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think whether the hardware changes from a smartphone or to something else, the fact of internet connectivity being able to go with you anywhere, that was the key evolution there. And the way I've put it is that once the internet could go into the bathroom with you, that's when everything changed. That's when you truly can't go anywhere any longer to not be connected to something. Now we might imagine that the internet is similar to the printing press, which that had, we just mentioned the Reformation earlier, revolutionary implications from everything from politics, economics, religion, family formation. I mean, just one of the most revolutionary inventions of all time. It had a democratizing effect as well, sort of a populist effect, empowering, creating widespread literacy, broad-based literacy, which did not exist before. And then it's really hard to imagine our economic, the market system, hard to imagine democratic politics. All of those things are just not possible without that printing press, at least as far as we would understand it. Now, you also identify the democratizing effect of the internet, which is very dramatic in its own way. Now, I'm going to throw a curveball at you here. I've heard it said that the internet is not so much akin to the printing press as it is to the invention of language itself. I don't remember where I heard it, but it's been a thought-provoking statement to me. What do you make of that? You think there's any truth to that?
I'd have to sit on that one for maybe a day or two.
That's a big one. That's a big one.
That's a big one. So I don't necessarily want to be super dogmatic. I think that that probably does express something, even if it's so, let's take it seriously, but not literally. I think that does express something that is true, which is that the internet is not simply, or we should say the internet is more than simply a new way of quote unquote doing language. The internet is a new language. So, you know, as opposed to the printing press where, you know, you have this new way of printing language. Well, you know, as Nicholas Carr shows in his book, The Shallows, the printing press doesn't simply kind of recapitulate language just on a new format. It creates a different kind of learner. So if you can give a person their own codex, then that person can actually have a one-on-one encounter with information that is unlike the tradition of oral learning. It's very much unlike that. So and I would encourage listeners to go read what Nicholas Carr says about the revolution that was. And so the internet really has that kind of same effect where it creates the hyper-connected learner. So you're learning how to read the way a computer reads. So you're just kind of skimming things. And then hypertext creates this kind of multidimensional rabbit hole that can connect you with ideas, but that are not necessarily connected logically, but they're connected aesthetically. And so it's almost like it's almost like a magazine that comes to life, where like this one article will be connected to this ad, which suggests that it's connected to this cause and this everything like that. And that's a, that's kind of an abstract way of understanding it. But I do think the internet is its own type of language. It's its own way of expressing ideas. And that's why, you know, if you took a person who spent their entire life in traditional educational institutions and, you know, you taught them habits of thinking that were common there, and you gave that person at the end of, you know, 21 years of formal education, if you gave that person a Twitter account and said, okay, now your goal is to, you know, put that, put all those habits of thinking to action in the world of Twitter, that person is going to despair, because what they're going to figure out is that the habits of thinking, the habits of learning, the way they formulate ideas, the way they communicate, the way they learned how to do that in traditional classroom structures has almost no purchase on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And so they're not going to be, they're almost not going to be able to communicate. And we've all seen, and I know you've seen it too, we've all seen examples of this in real life, of people that struggle to articulate themselves in a digital commons. And it's not because they're unintelligent. In fact, it's often case the opposite. Often they're the probably opposite, more intelligent than most of their commentators, but it's they just don't think like the internet. And so I do think there's some truth in the idea that this is a new language. It's not simply recapitulating what we already know in a different format. It's a new way of thinking. And that's kind of what the book is about.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Again, talking to Samuel James about digital liturgies, rediscovering Christian wisdom in an online age, from Crossway. Now, here's another thought I had, Samuel. In the internet age, unprecedented wealth accrues to young entrepreneurs. Jobs go to graduates with the most recent education. What would you describe are the spiritual implications of this inversion of power from the older to the younger?
Well, I think of that episode in the Old Testament where the son of Solomon, I think, had an opportunity to be king over a united kingdom, and he asked the older guys, "What should I say?" And they said, "Hey, speak kindly to this people, and they will be your servants forever." And then he goes to ask his text thread, his buddies, what he should say, and they said, they said, my little finger is thicker than my father's thigh. Like, you know, crack the whips on these jokes. And so he followed what his younger friends told him to do, and the kingdom of Israel has not been united since. I think that's just a biblical anecdote that illustrates the power and the consequences of divorcing knowledge received from generations. So and it doesn't matter if it's happening upward or downward, because it happens both ways. We're not just saying it's always the younger versus the older. But when you separate the generations and they no longer transmit to one another, really bad things happen. And I would suggest to anyone interested in this topic to go read Gene Twenge's book, Generations, which captures, I think, in a dispassionate, very fair way, how generations change from one group to the next based on experiences and unique cultural events that take over. So I think one of the spiritual effects of kind of the inversion of expertise and the inversion of cultural power is that you're going to see a lot of wisdom just lost. You're going to see a lot of life experience just lost. And I think this is probably has something to do with the conversations about delayed and foregone marriage and not having children and people not able to settle down or not able to understand the opposite sex. I think you're seeing this handicap of life primarily because we, as a society, we've been trending toward this way of existence where people are immediately sorted into their peer group and they almost never get out and they almost never experience a meaningful relationship with someone who is a generation older than them. And unfortunately, there's a lot of churches where that's the case as well. Everyone is sorted so neatly into their age group and there's not that cross-generational discipleship. And what do you lose when you lose that? Well, one of the evidences, I think, is that you lose
young people who know how to form attachments. They know how that they might be very good at school. They might be very good at making money. They might be very good at building a platform for themselves, at kind of projecting themselves. That's what young people do, right? Young people put their foot forward. They're good at kind of being charismatic and attracting attention to themselves. Yeah. It's as we age that we learn the skills of relationship, that we learn how to build things that last, that we learn how to cultivate relationships that end up resonating throughout generations. We are literally laying down the pathway for future generations. That can only happen as we age. And I think that inversion of authority that you're talking about is going to result in a lot of, you know, what Zuckerberg called move fast and break things. You're going to see a lot of that. You're going to see a lot of dynamism, but you're not going to see a lot that passes the test of time.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. I mean, you're talking in this book about the way that new technologies create new cultural narratives. It's just interesting that you can't imagine an older person making an invention that would be significant today. Hmm. I mean, that's just, does not fit our cultural narrative in there. And yet that says, okay, what does that tell us? I mean, that communicates a story that old people are fundamentally a problem because they don't really contribute to the future. And maybe that's why you see a lot of movements toward euthanasia in places like Canada, especially in parts of Western Europe. I don't know, but I mean, that's just a good example of how technology will have those effects and how different other cultures are. This is just basic cultural anthropology that the West would be an anomaly, especially compared to native cultures in places like North America or East Asian cultures or all sorts of other places where the inversion, where your elders are honored and sort of those things are. But we just, that doesn't really make a lot of sense to us for a lot of reasons, but especially now, I think, because of the way the sort of technology works with the internet in particular. You also write in the book, Samuel, that the hashtag killed moral relativism. So briefly, can you give us a bit of a theology of repentance for the internet age? Like, what should we do or not do there? I mean, I was a guest that I've had recently on Gospel Bound, Yasha Monk, talks about these internet swarms and that we see all the different times. Certainly you see it in my position, but we all see it happen to someone and we all kind of know it's going to happen to us eventually. It just kind of the way the internet works, it's always looking for its daily or weekly target in those ways. He says, you really only apologize if you've done something wrong. And it's interesting how often there seems to be no consideration for whether somebody has done anything truly wrong, right, but merely how other people feel about the situation. And then it takes on an entire life of its own where the repentance seems to be utterly disconnected from any truth or validity, but merely as a way of sort of satiating the mob. So again, what does a theology of repentance look like in the internet age?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think in our own culture, there's almost an inversion of the relationship between guilt and public repentance. So the more actually guilty a person is, the less likely they are to give an authentic apology. I don't mean to pick on the NFL. I'm an NFL fan, but I mean, you have a lot of athletes who actually get caught in domestic abuse situations, or they get caught, you know, drunk driving and hitting somebody. And the apology that comes out is, I'm sorry for the people I've disappointed. You know, that kind of just, the issue is not me. The issue is all these other people who are disappointed in me. And then when you have a comedian who, you know, their jokes from 10 years ago are dug up on Twitter, they come out with this very earnest, I'm not the person I was. Like, I can't believe this was me. I've undergone so much growth. I totally repudiate this other version of me. And so it's almost like you've got this total inversion where the guiltier a person is, the more inauthentic their apology
will happens
likely be.
In politics and in international affairs. Like, the bigger the sin, the less you have to apologize for it. Yeah. It's almost like the smaller, the more fixated everybody right. becomes on it. And then when you show that you begin to actually apologize, then it seems like that becomes an opportunity for people to actually demand more and more yeah. and more. And you realize you can't really ever get on the other side of yeah. it. There's no propitiation ultimately, right. and certainly no expiation, either side of that.
I kind of wonder if the reason for that is with a, you know, let's think in terms of sins and faux pas. When someone commits a faux pas, the apology is authentic because they think that actually they can get past it, because they yeah. think if they're just apologetic enough, they can make it yeah. go away.
Yeah.
And it, when you're dealing with a sin, like something that is very extreme, because we don't have the gospel, because we don't, if you're an unbeliever, you don't have the gospel, you don't have a theology of atonement and forgiveness. There's almost this despair, this cynical despair that pops up that like, well, I can't even do anything about this. I can't get past this. This has now defined my life. So I might as well not grovel about it, because that just makes it worse. There's no way to kind of take this stain off of my life. And so, yeah. and so it's interesting how Christian theology is the exact opposite. Christian theology says that in sin, we are all guilty, but there is a real mechanism for atonement. And I think this is why social media has become defined by activism. Because activism, really secular activism, much of it is this kind of way to kind of scapegoat and to rid the community of this evil, but you don't have a object of reconciliation. You don't have an atonement. So, you know, I know you have been very influenced, as I have, by Wilfred MacLay's magisterial essay on the strange disappearance of guilt, which I recommend to everyone and quote in the book. And I think that is, to this day, one of the best articulations of where society that has denied real guilt and real propitiation ends up, just throwing all of its moral energy at purging these faux pas from its midst because it doesn't know how to process guilt. And so I think Christians in the digital age, I think, have an opportunity to be known, you're Christian, you guys are the ones who actually believe in forgiveness. You guys are the ones who actually take in people who have sinned, and you say that God loves you and has made a way for you to be forgiven. You people are the ones who don't throw people away. Why is that? What do you mean by that? And I think Christians are going to be some of the only people who do that, who teach that way. Because without a theology of atonement, without a theology of reconciliation that is divine, you're just going to see more and more moral energy expended upon trying to punish enemies and reward friends and that kind of thing. And I think that's why we're seeing this little movement of non-Christian liberals who are kind of breaking from progressivism precisely for this reason, because they say, well, this is, liberalism has become punitive. I don't want any part of it. And often people like Andrew Sullivan or other people like that end up talking almost unintentionally biblically about the relationship between forgiveness and sin, but they just don't have the belief for it. They don't have the faith actually in the Messiah to do that. So I think Christians have an enormous opportunity to witness just through the way we actually believe that forgiveness is real and possible.
Yeah, I think in a post-Christian and in an internet age, the ways we tend to stand out are not by trying to keep up with all the different changes, but by doubling down on basic practices and basic wisdom that get lost. You've mentioned earlier going to church, having actual in-person friends. I think we could take it a few steps further. Actually, still getting married and having kids. That's practically, I mean, in many major cities, that's already wildly countercultural for Christians or Mormons or Orthodox Jews, things like that. But that's becoming more of the norm. So just getting married, just having kids, not getting rid of your elderly, actually caring for your elderly. That's another thing that's going to be something that comes to characterize Christians and sets them apart. And then having a process by which people can find refuge from internet shame, but also find refuge from where real repentance, I repent of that sin, I've turned from that, I've accepted the forgiveness that's made possible through the blood of Jesus Christ, and now I can walk forward where people can be restored. in a place where your record, not just criminally, but even just on the internet, just follows you everywhere, and it cannot mm-hmm. really be expunged. The internet just doesn't forget. Yeah. There, those are just some basic things that I see. Let me ask you this as a quick question: what are some, you know, Samuel, you're so digitally connected as I am. As much as we're talking about this stuff, I think in part it's because we're so fully immersed in it that we perceive so many more of the dangers because it's an occupational hazard in many ways for our work. What are some of the most important habits you employ to stay connected to embodied and also spiritual reality? Because both of them get easily distorted by the internet.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I apologize for saying that. My wife told me a few months ago, you know, when you're on a podcast, you say that's a great question.
Very flattering. Very flattering.
But you know, Colin Hanson just asked really great question after great question. So
this, you really mean it. It's flattery with all the other hosts, but it's real right. when you're talking.
Right,
to
it's
me.
Real. I would not flatter you, Mr. Colin. I think it's so important for people to think about this. And I, Digital Liturgies, my book, the number one criticism that I've gotten from the book or about the book is that it's not practical enough and that it doesn't really offer enough practical suggestions. On one level, I concede the point. I wish I would have written much more about practices. But on another level, I think partly that was intentional. And the reason is that when you dive deep into biblical wisdom, you start to see the reality that according to the Bible, wisdom is about becoming a certain kind of person, not necessarily knowing what sort of rules to follow. So there's always this inward direction with wisdom. Wisdom is always kind of pushing toward the heart, and it's always trying to create certain kinds of people. And I think one of the reasons for that is there's far too many scenarios that you may run into in real life than there are Bible verses for that you can clearly say, like, this is clearly wrong, I should not do this, or this is clearly right, I should do this. Those situations exist, and probably there's more of them than modern people like you and I would even want to admit. But there are way too many scenarios in life where really the question is going to be, what kind of person am I? What kind of person am I wanting to become? Where are my instincts? Where are my loves? What am I treasuring most? What do I most want to be 10, 20, 30 years from now? And so I think when we think about habits, that's where I start. And so partly that has meant one of my foundational habits is to bring other people into my tech use. So for me, it's been my wife. So I have social media memberships where she has the password and I don't. And what that means is I have to say, hey, could you log me in? Now, I say that to people and I see the look on their eyes and they go, hey, I'm calling whatever authority I have to call to report your, you know, dysfunctional marriage. And I know that sounds Byzantine, but for somebody like me to bring another person into my relationship with tech automatically creates this barrier of wisdom. And I'm not saying it's infallible. I'm not saying it can't be overcome, but it's a barrier of wisdom where if I have to admit to her that I've been hooked on Twitter or whatever for the last 72 hours, you know, debating with people who are wrong online, if I have to implicitly admit to her, it forces me to implicitly admit it to myself. And I'm like, you know what? I probably should disengage from this. And Colin, I think one of the things that a vast majority of people who have these technologies, they don't have anyone like that in their life. They don't have anyone like that they want to invite. I've counseled a lot of guys through pornography addictions and things like that. The vast majority of them can't even countenance the idea of somebody having their screen time code for their iPhone, much less just a general social media password. That the idea of privacy, the idea that I should be able to have a one-on-one relationship with this technology that nobody else should be pulled into and nobody else should be able to tell me how to use it, is so woven deeply into our conscience as Americans. And I think in terms of practices, you can start there. We can start by bringing other people into our tech use. And it might look like sharing passwords. It might look like, hey, inviting someone at church to say, hey, if you ever see me post anything that you're like, I don't know about, feel free to message me and say, hey, I don't know about this. It, you know, take that proactive step and then create rhythms of Sabbath. You know, I love Andy Crouch's, I think it's an hour a day, one day a week, and one week a year, I think of being totally unplugged. And I realize this is going to look different for different people in different seasons of life. And the Lord knows that. But I love the idea of taking just 1 hour a day, preferably not between 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. when you're stone asleep, so you can satisfy that requirement. but taking a conscious hour out of your day to say, hey, I'm not going to be bothered by what's out there. I'm going to attend to what's in here. I'm going to attend to my responsibilities. I'm going to attend to these friends. I'm going to attend these relationships. I'm just going to sit down with the Word, and I'm not going to take a picture of my Bible and post it to Instagram. Just getting away from that noise reminds you that it's like coming up for air when you've been underwater. It reminds you, oh, wait, this is what it's like to actually live life out from under the digital gaze. So those are two very basic habits that I think anyone is capable of pursuing.
Well, that's really helpful. Let's keep in that vein here as we wrap up. Let's do the last three quickly here, talking with Samuel James, author of Digital Liturgies, Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in an Online Age. All right, again, quick answers here. Number one, what is the most important advice you'd give to parents?
Reject privacy.
Okay, reject privacy. Related to what you just said right there, the assumption of the internet age is privacy. That's the cultural narrative. So if you reject that premise, it changes everything. Okay, very good. That's good. Second, what's the most important advice you'd give to pastors?
Watch your own soul.
Okay. Expand on that one a little bit.
Yeah, I'll expand on that one. Okay. So I think one of the temptations, Colin, for pastors right now is going to be to use social media and the internet to alleviate the symptoms of pastoring. And what I mean by that is pastoring is hard. For a lot of pastors, pastoring is lonely. And for a lot of pastors, pastoring is obscure, that no one sees their sacrifice. No one is emailing and texting them saying, well done, great sermon. Thank you for being at my mother's bedside last night.
Right.
Their labor is obscure. And I think the temptation for pastors is often to go to social media and to be the public theologian that you don't feel like you can be with just your embodied ministry.
Yeah, that's good. One of the things I always appreciate about your perspective, Samuel, is having grown up in a pastor's home. And you often bring that to bear. That's really helpful to me, especially as I'm trying to parent my kids and talking to pastors, but having never been on the other side of that, it's helpful. All right, last question. I'm going to make you TGC's editor-in-chief for a day. Don't let it get to your head. The pay's not great and the responsibility is not what you'd think, but here's the question you need to answer. Interesting, one of the things you talk about in the cultural narrative is how it prioritizes stories over arguments. The internet conveys stories more so than arguments. So here's your decision. Would you invest in building a great TikTok account?
No.
Okay. Tell me why.
I think the medium is the message. And I think TikTok, first of all, other than being this glaring national security threat our elites apparently don't have that much motivation to address.
Or are paid off by a certain...
Or are paid off. Yeah, we'll say whatever reason it is. I don't want to get any messages from my elected representatives on this one. I think the medium is the message. I think TikTok is, of course, capable of broadcasting gospel truth, but I think that medium will always tend toward a way of thinking and a way of processing information that is hostile to biblical wisdom.
Yeah, I had was meeting with some Christian college students a couple years ago, and they were saying, effectively, if it's not on TikTok, we don't see it. Our generation just doesn't really care about anything else. It's all TikTok. And I thought, huh. And then I just said, well, and they were talking about how distressing that is, about how many arguments or how many stories or how many 1 minute tearing down the Bible. Christians are wrong about everything. Christians are immoral. The Bible is stupid. Anybody who believes it is stupid, that they see all of the time, how popular those accounts are. And I thought, well, don't you think a ministry like the Gospel Coalition should be there to try to help respond or help, you know, to tell different stories? And they were like, they were repelled by the idea. They just said, that sounds horrible. No, you shouldn't do that. And I said, wait a minute. But if I'm trying to reach your generation, how could I not do TikTok? And it just, you could just see them try to process and say, wait a minute. The only thing we care about is TikTok, yet the medium doesn't allow Christianity. It doesn't work. And I thought, oh boy, there's a lot to ponder there. And ultimately, Samuel, it's why I think your book is really helpful, because that's the kind of book that helps people to connect these dots that are floating out there. And you're thinking, how can these things coexist? And they're very concerning. But then you go back to, okay, what are the principles of disengagement that we need to implement to be able to preserve genuine wisdom? So check out Samuel's book, Digital Liturgies, Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in an Online Age. You can also, I'm sure you've read his work at Crossway, whether you know it or not. Books like Andrew Wilson's Remaking the World, Samuel played a crucial role in. And also check out his newsletter, Digital Liturgies. Samuel, thanks again for joining me on Gospel Bound.
Thanks, Colin.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Gospel Bound. For more interviews and to sign up for my newsletter, head over to tgc.org/gospelbound. Rate and review Gospel Bound on your favorite podcast platform so others can join the conversation. Until next time, remember, when we're bound to the gospel, we abound in hope.